Yeah, I'll start. Maybe I should start by thanking the organizer for letting me speak. Actually, the organizer had no intention of letting me speak, but so this lecture was to have been given by Gunther Ullmann. He had to delay his trip by a day, and so the organizer forced me to speak. And so I thought I would use the opportunity to ease you into this symposium on inverse problems, and also set the stage for some of the other speakers. So the first thing I'd like to say is that this will be a pedagogical symposium. It takes place inside the PDE year, and I know most participants are not experts on inverse problems. And so it is meant for you, it is meant to give a lot of background and explain things more or less at graduate student level. So there will be five speakers, and they will each talk for 3 times 50 minutes or twice an hour and a half. And the idea was to give them enough time to explain things to the point where they can be of use to you. And even so, they might not get to the latest, they might or might not get to the latest research they've been involved in. The next thing I should say is that this by no means aims to cover all of inverse problems. It's now a big area, and there are parts of it that we won't touch, which doesn't mean I'm not interested in them. So most of this will not talk about applications or numerical work. We won't talk about obstacles. We won't talk about lots of things. That'll have to be for maybe another such symposium, but not next week. Okay, so rather, the talks will have a common thread, and I'm going to try to. So my aim for today is to present the common thread to convince you that there have been some breakthroughs i.e. theorems in the field, but also to mention at least three open problems which haven't made it to the $1 million list yet, but trust me, they're plenty hard. And so to explain what an inverse problem is, I'm going to pick the one problem which somehow was crucial in the development of this field, and that's although you might get a slightly different view on that issue from Slava Kurilev. And that's what's known as Calderon's problem. At least it's known by that name to the mathematicians. In the medical imaging community, it goes by the unfortunate name of electric impedance tomography. That's right, that's why it's unfortunate. I don't make the name, the news, I just report it. So The first wonderful thing about this problem is that I can state it without mentioning any mathematics. So what Calderon basically asked is it possible to determine the electric conductivity inside a body from voltage and current measurements at the surface. So in a moment I will give you the mathematical translation of this. He actually had a two-part question. Part two of the question, if so, give a method to calculate the conductivity. And maybe I should say here variable. So the conductivity is not a number, it's a function. Calculate the conductivity from this data. And he published this in a paper around 1980. And by putting in writing that he couldn't do it, made it interesting for mathematicians to jump on. Alberto Grunbaum tells the story that Calderon had this in his drawer from the 40s, and I guess those of us whose life has been changed by this problem are happy he published, waited until 1980 to publish it. But also somehow, there's been some understanding since. So in some sense, the mathematics was just ripe for the problem in the 80s, and maybe it was not in the 40s. He thought of the main application. Calderon, by the way, had an engineering background. For those of you, the young ones in the audience, I should perhaps mention he went on to be one of the greatest analysts of the previous century. And so he had, so what's the body? The body could be the Earth, and that's the example he had in mind. Or it could be your body. Which is the main, let's just call it impedance imaging. That's the main application I'm familiar with. Since your body functions electrochemically, trying to have an image of the variable conductivity inside your body will give you information which is not given by other imaging modalities like ultrasound or X-ray or MRI. And each of those, by the way, corresponds to a different mathematical problem. They're all inverse problems. There is actually work when the body is the Earth. For instance, there are people making careful electric measurements on Mount Vesuvius and Mount Etna, trying to figure out the shape of the magma chamber. Right, so the issue is not whether they will erupt, the issue is how bad it'll be when they erupt. And the shape of the magma chamber is precious information. At any rate, let's see what this means in math. So in math, your body looks like this, with no prejudice. And it's in Rn. And we're usually going to assume that it has no big holes. Yes, we are. So this is the fact it doesn't have holes, we'll just say that the complement is connected. And I'm going to, for the applied people in the audience, I'm going to put some technical math assumptions, and you can treat those as noise. So one technical math assumption is that the boundary is usually assumed Lipschitz, which means corners are typically allowed. So the body has a conductivity which varies with position, and that's, so different organs have different conductivity. In fact, the same organ at different times might have different conductivity. So that's what we're after. So if the electric potential very good question. For now, it's going to be a scalar. So in other words, sigma. So when sigma is real valued, we call the material isotropic. When sigma is matrix valued, so an n by n matrix, we call it anisotropic. And that corresponds to different conductivities at a point in different directions. So, you know, muscles, your heart, are agreed to be very much anisotropic. And one of the open problems I'm going to mention is in that context. But much of, I mean, Calderon formulated it for scalar-valued sigma, and that's what I'm going to assume for the moment. So say it's positive. All right, so if U is the electric potential, then sigma grad U is what's called the current density. Now that should be a little intuitive if you remember Ohm's law. So Ohm's law basically says the current is voltage over resistivity. Grad U basically is the voltage drop. Sigma conductivity is like 1 over the resistivity. So this should be the current. And if there are no sources or sinks of current in your body, we find that the electric potential satisfies this nice elliptic PDE. So this is in omega. And we sometimes say U is sigma harmonic. So if sigma is 1, this is just Laplace's equation. if sigma is variable, well, then it's a variable coefficient version of that in divergence form. And let's say U is F on the boundary. So given F on the boundary, there is a unique U that solves this problem. So this is a Dirichlet problem. Motivation I just described. I said this is the current, and there are no sinks or sources of current inside. So the divergence is zero. So you can also look in the Bible, meaning at Maxwell's equations. And if there are no sinks or sources of current, you find this equation. It's one of the basic ingredients in Maxwell's equation. All right. So if you know sigma, and I give you the potential on the boundary, right, given, so you have to imagine physically, you imagine yourself with electrodes stuck to your body as you would for an EKG. So on those electrodes, we place a voltage, hopefully not too high. And if the conductivity is known at every point inside, solving this problem is a well-understood classical question. So this would be the forward. In this field's parlance, it's called the forward problem. Furthermore, for any such F, there is a unique U. So define an operator on the boundary . So if you want to be technical, this would be, for example, on Sobolev H, a half on the boundary. On nice functions on the boundary, you can define this. This would be called the Dirichlet to Neumann map. Or the, which basically for every voltage F on the boundary gives you the normal component of the current. So you can show lambda is a nice operator which takes H a half to H minus a half. This is noise for the applied people. And for the applied people, this is called the voltage to current map. So this we owe to Calderon. It's to present this in a nice, clean, elegant formulation where the data, voltage and current measurements, is encoded in knowledge of this operator. So for every voltage F, I have the corresponding current. What is what? Oh, thank you. Mu is the unit normal. The outer unit normal to the boundary. Yeah, right. So that's what you measure. Now, right away, if omega is the Earth, you don't expect to be able to make measurements all around. That's even the case for your body. And so we come to the first advertisement, which is that for partial data, so measuring only on some subset of the boundary. There's some nice results that Hiroshi Isozaki will talk about. Starting today at 2. He has had the wonderful idea, which sent little ripples in the field, of using hyperbolic manifolds to get answers to problems in Euclidean space. And so that's one of the things that he's, that's basically the theme of his lectures. Correct me if I'm wrong, Hiroshi. So, so what we have here, if sigma is fixed, this is of course a linear map. If you double the voltage, you get twice as much current. But sigma going to this is highly nonlinear. And so what we have here is basically work on, so these are nonlinear problems on linear PDEs. So I say this knowing that many of the people in the audience are interested in nonlinear PDEs. Well, so before you get going on these inverse problems, you have to have a handle on the forward problems. Existence, uniqueness, if sigma is nice, do we have a unique U? The answer is, of course, yes. But when you're done with existence, uniqueness, and regularity, right, here the fun begins. So what we're trying to understand is this map. So the question when inverse people say uniqueness, and this is part one of Calderon's question, is the injectivity of this map, i.e., if two conductivities give you the same measurements, does that imply they're the same? Right? If it doesn't, then it's not possible to determine fully the conductivity. And so uniqueness, even in the applied community, they are waiting for us mathematicians to, that's one of the nice things in this field, is people care about getting the answer from you. To prove uniqueness. Part two of Calderon's problem, I'd like to call reconstruction. Give a method to invert this map. In other words, if I give you this boundary data, can you find sigma? In a sense which I will not have time to talk about at all, this is analogous to some form of nonlinear harmonic analysis. So here this would be like saying if two functions have the same Fourier transform, they must be the same. Whereas reconstruction would be, well, do you have a Fourier inversion theorem? Do you have a way to actually compute? I was very interested in this problem, as I'll mention in a second, but it will not appear in most of the talks in this particular symposium will be on the uniqueness question. There's also the question of stability. So what do we mean by stability here? It's simply continuity of the map of the inverse map, i.e., and preferably with estimates. In other words, if this is small in an appropriate norm, does that so if your measurements are close, this is very important in applications because your measurements are never exact. So if you're close, does that mean that the reconstruction you get is close to the true one? And the answer for this problem is unfortunately no. So this is what's called stability. This is what's called an ill-posed problem. It's possible to have this very small and not notice big differences in the conductivities, especially as you move away from the boundary. On what? Right. So we regularize. So this is continuous. I'll just say here, since problem ill-posed, we regularize by restricting to smoother sigma. So if you assume a priori that you only look at conductivities which are reasonably smooth, then you can prove some rather weak continuity. So, I mean, continuity by itself in practice isn't enough. You want this to be somehow comparable to that. All right. So, those are the problems. Let me tell you a little bit about what's known. And then I'll move on to the anisotropic problem. So the first result which really kick-started the business was by... before we say that, one thing that inverse people do is we count variables, naive variable count. All right, so let's say sigma depends on a function on n or function of n variables. Now, formally, lambda fxy is has a Schwarz kernel. In other words, you can at least formally write it as, lambda x, right, thanks. So it formally has a kernel, actually it actually has a kernel because it turns out to be a pseudo-differential operator of order one. It's like taking derivative once. And so here we're on the boundary. So the boundary has dimension n minus 1. So n minus 1 x's, n minus 1 y's. Lambda depends on, so the data has two n minus 1 variables. So in, if you don't like Schwarz kernels, just think intuitively that y is your source, right? And x is the receiver. It's the place where you look at the response. So for every fixed source, you have dimension n minus 1 x's, and then you can move the source around. And so for n equals 1, n is less than 2n minus 1, the problem is underdetermined. And so uniqueness, the uniqueness question, the answer is easily seen to be no. You can do this on the back of an envelope, just do it, you know, you're now on a segment. But also intuitively, if you have a piece of wire and you can put voltages at the ends and measure what happens at the ends, all you'll get is the average resistivity of the wire. So you just get some, on a segment, you get 1 over sigma. That's all you can, is all we can determine. So that's a cute little problem in ODEs. For n equals 2, n bigger than or equal to 3, wait a second. This is data. So, sorry, I had my thing going the wrong way. This is too little data for what we want to recover. In higher dimension, there's lots more data. The problem is overdetermined. And the answer to the uniqueness question is yes. So that was the result I mentioned, 1987, by John Sylvester and Gunther Ullmann. So the answer to Calderon's question is yes, for at least for part one, if the conductivity and the boundary are assumed smooth. And so they were the first to prove a crucial estimate, which makes the whole game going. As you flex your harmonic analysis muscle and you prove sharper estimates in worse spaces, there's a mini industry on lower regularity. And so the today's state of the art this is today, or at least yesterday, I didn't check my Google yet today, is 3/2 derivatives in L infinity. So this is sigma, and the boundary is Lipschitz. And now we come to the a major open problem. What about sigma in L infinity? This, if you remember your Sobolev embedding theorem, implies sigma is continuous. Well, you don't. If you have 3/2 derivative, that's obvious. So in real life, conductivities have jumps. They need not be continuous. And furthermore, so that's for real life and for mathematics, Calderon happened to state it for bounded conductivities. So the question is, this is a big open problem. And it's not just a matter of flexing mathematical muscle. State of the art already includes things like Pfefferman-Fong inequalities. So I think a new idea is needed in understanding this. Okay, so for n equal 2, for n equal 2, so from this variable count, you might start to get a feeling that 2 is harder than 3 for the inverse problem. You have less data. So the problem is formally determined. And the answer is yes, that's something that I proved in 96. Another thing that I did is reconstruction. So that's harder to state as a theorem, but what I did is I gave a method first here, and then almost, I don't know, 7 years later in two dimensions, a method whereby if you're good at, or if your computer, oh no, right, I didn't do that. Thank you. So down here. If you're good at solving linear integral equations on the computer, this method gives you an exact reconstruction procedure. No approximations are thrown in. And in fact, this was numerically the 2D one, although analytically more complicated, numerically it's easier to play with 2D. So numerically this was implemented by Samuli Siltanen, Jennifer Müller, and David Isaacson. And somewhere in this column, which there should, I should say stability, the stability estimate I won't list them, but they're around in case you're interested. For both n equals 3, that was Alessandrini, and they're also for n equals 2. All right. In a weak sense, you know, they are logarithmic stability estimates, which means useless for practical purposes. Is that proved? I see. Okay. So if you want better stability, okay. Okay, so Slava Kurilev just pointed out that there are counterexamples showing you cannot have more than logarithmic stability estimates. And so if you want better stability in practice, you just have to restrict even more the kinds of conductivities you're going to look at. So, for instance, I don't know if you... Right. So even polynomial? even polynomial conductivities?
No, no, no. I mean, polynomial time dimension.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's the logarithmic norms, right? Of course, you can hide the logarithmic dependence into the norm, right? So they tend to be fairly well behaved near the boundary. So if you put something that decays exponentially as you move away from the boundary, yeah, you can. All right. Now, yes?
Getting back to the variable count.
Right.
Because I can't distinguish the difference in that variable count between Taylor's conductivity
right.
and tensorial conductivity.
I can't either. So that's why it's naive and it's sort of only. Okay. But the natives are getting restless, so let's talk about anisotropic conductivities. So for anisotropic conductivities, sigma is a matrix. So now the basic PDE becomes some equal to zero, and the Dirichlet-Neumann map, so still U is F on the boundary. U is still scalar. Grad U is a vector, sigma is a matrix applied to that vector. And this is the normal dotted with sigma grad U. So if you think about this for a little bit, you come up with the observation, and this one I guess is due to Luc Tartar, that if you change variables, you can fool the Dirichlet-Neumann map and get different conductivities. So suppose we take y is f of x, a map capital F. I don't have any little f, any capital F on the board. You want phi? I was saving phi, but I won't get time to what I was saving it for, so. Yes, sir? Positive definite, yes. Don't cut into my punchline. So. But thank you for setting it up. So phi just is just a diffeomorphism. So just think of it as changing variables in omega. And then if you say u is v of phi of x, many esteemed colleagues get this a little bit wrong, so I had to redo it for the nth time last night. And you ask yourself, what equation will V satisfy? Okay? So V of Y is the electric potential in some new coordinates Y. It will also satisfy such an equation. And I'm going... F, oops, Thank you. Phi sub star, I don't want to use fancy words, so I'll just call this the new conductivity. You can, it's a little exercise to figure out what that should be. DFI, DXP, oops, thank you. DXQ, sigma PQ. And all of that evaluated at x equal phi inverse of y. And Luc Tartar's observation is that if phi is identity on the boundary, so you only look at diffeomorphisms which don't move any point on the boundary. It's an exercise for the interested reader that the corresponding Dirichlet to Neumann maps for the two conductivities will be the same. So, by the way, since you've seen Dirichlet to Neumann maps in the wonderful series of lectures that just ended yesterday, there the interest was in the Dirichlet to Neumann map and its dependence on a domain. Here the domain stays fixed and we're varying the coefficients in the equation. But people are interested in the problem with variable domains as well. On the boundary. And you can check that. The easiest way to check is to look at the weak formulation of the PDE, and it just change variables in the integral and it drops out. And so the answer to the uniqueness is simply no. You cannot distinguish these two anisotropic conductivities from the Dirichlet to Neumann map. And so a natural conjecture is this the only obstruction to uniqueness? So if lambda sigma 1 equal lambda 2 would imply there exists a phi with phi equals identity on the boundary such that sigma 2 is phi star of sigma 1. This problem is easier in 2D than in 3D. So for n equals 2, the answer is yes. And this is due to Sylvester and yours truly. John Sylvester showed how you can use isothermal coordinates . So this is very special to 2D. The construction goes essentially back to Alfors. So given a sigma, a little 2x2 matrix value function, you can find a phi which makes this phi star sigma isotropic, or as geometers would say, conformal to the identity. So a scalar function times the identity. And so that reduces to my 2D result. For n bigger than or equal to 3, this is my next big open problem. It's a lovely open problem. And the more you think about it, the lovelier it gets. I may go a little past 12:30 with your permission, since without your permission, we started late. Because I want to get to the good stuff. So, as the other Adrian in the audience noticed, put this on aside for a second, and suppose you open any book on Riemannian geometry. So Riemannian geometry comes from a way to measure distances, which here would be given by a positive definite. So it's by an inner product on tangent vectors. An inner product can be described, at least locally, by a positive definite matrix, Gij, at each point. And that's called a Riemannian metric. And correspondingly, what is a harmonic function on a Riemannian manifold? Well, there's the Laplace-Beltrami operator. Which, written out locally, so for every Riemannian metric, there is such a thing. And the formula is, Ij, Di, G to the 1/2, Gij, Dju, where traditionally little g is the determinant of this matrix, and G upper Ij is the inverse matrix. And so it's obvious to the naked eye, right, that any Laplace-Beltrami operator is in fact an anisotropic, corresponds to an anisotropic conductivity, namely sigma ij equals g to the 1/2 gij. If you compare this equation with the equation dgu equals 0. So that sigma harmonic functions are in fact just harmonic function on this Riemannian manifold. So conversely, given sigma, you can recover G. So you have to figure out first the determinant from this relation, and you'll get, again, this, you'll see this wrong in many papers. But so this only works in dimensions 3 and higher. So metrics are conductivities. In dimensions 3 and higher, every conductivity corresponds to a Riemannian metric. In 2D, only conductivities with determinant 1 correspond to metrics. And in that case, it's not. There's very little data besides the topology. And so, this, which takes one metric to another, if you have a diffeomorphism which takes one metric to another, we call it an isometry between the Riemannian metrics. And the Riemannian structure, right, is something which does not depend on the particular coordinates. So we do not distinguish Riemannian manifolds which are isometric. And so this observation, this non-uniqueness observation, becomes trivial if in this language. We simply want, let's put the conjecture positively. So the conjecture becomes, does the Dirichlet-Neumann map for a Riemannian metric determine the metric up to isometry? And so the punchline I was trying to get to is, here we are happily as engineers putting down an equation. We don't want to hear about differential geometry. And I know secretly some of you don't want to hear about differential geometry. And yet, there it is. It appears, and you ignore it at your own peril. And so at this point, if you're just mathematicians, you like this problem because it's very close to, it brings back the spirit of Riemann. What do I mean by that? Well, one of the basic questions Riemann asked himself is, given 2GIJ, two metrics, how can I tell if it's really the same metric corresponding to a change of variable? And the answer came, well, that's how he came up with the definition of the Riemannian curvature tensor. So the answer is, they are the same if their curvatures are the same. Okay, but there's a little problem with that. Here's the manifold, here's a copy. You want the curvature here to be the same as the curvature there. So how do you know which points to compare? Right? There's a theorem around these, along these lines. You may have heard of it. It's called the Cartan-Ambrose-Hicks theorem, which basically says you follow geodesics by parallel transport, and that sort of tells you how to, which thing to compare to which. Well, this would be sort of a PDE version of the answer to that. You would be simply, you don't have to do stuff like that. You simply sit on the boundary and compare the Dirichlet to Neumann maps. And if the Dirichlet to Neumann maps are the same, and if this conjecture is true, then the two metrics would be isometric. Well, something as wonderful as that, in fact, is true. So I should emphasize, Sylvester and my result in 2D doesn't say this, because in 2D we're not talking about metrics. But a result like this is true so yes, provided we change from Laplace-Beltrami So by the way, Günther Ullmann will take over from here in his lecture and talk about anisotropic problems, I expect from the microlocal point of view. Before I get to this punchline, I should say, since geometry becomes crucial, I've also invited Chris Croak, who is a differential geometer and was surprised to be invited to at a PDE conference. But the plus side for us is that he's supposed to give his lectures assuming we know no differential geometry. And he's going to talk about a related problem where in a manifold, in a Riemannian manifold, I give you the distance between any two points on the boundary. So again, you're sitting on the boundary, and you're looking at, you're given how far or how long it takes to get from one point to any other point. Can you from that determine the metric? The answer is no, but yes, sometimes. But I don't want to cut into his punchline. The Dirichlet-Neumann map does determine the metric if instead of the Laplace-Beltrami operator, you look at the wave operator. And give the corresponding Dirichlet-Neumann map. Now, by now, you may have a sense that this makes the problem easier because instead of giving it at one frequency, I give it to you as a function of time, and so you have it at lots of frequency. That gives you more data. And so this beautiful result will be the subject of Slava Kurilev's talk. And it depends on a unique continuation. So the basic theorem he'll mention depends on a unique continuation result of Tataru, which involves a subtle Karlemann estimate. And so I've invited Viktor Isakov to talk about Karlemann estimates. And I've insisted that he should start with the easiest equation you can write down and explain this. So Karlemann estimates, I think also for nonlinear people, you ignore them at your own peril. What they are is weighted estimates. So this is a pure PDE talk. Weighted estimates where the weights emphasize places of interest and de-emphasize places where you either have no control in the solution or you don't care what it looks like. Now it gets better than that. Slava Kurilev combined with, let me see if I can remember, Michael Anderson, Katsura, Matti Lassas, and Michael Taylor. Do I have all of them? Yes. Have looked at the problem of stability. For this. So, okay, you can determine the Riemannian metric. What can you say about stability? And so now we're talking about when are two Riemannian manifolds, how do we talk about closeness of Riemannian manifolds? So that's a concept due to Gromov. It requires some regularity theorems about metrics when you have control. So the application requires when you have control on the Ricci curvature. So stuff like this had been done, I think, before, but here it is done for manifolds with boundary, and so the curvature of the boundary also comes in. We're looking forward to hearing about that again. Hopefully with all the background we need from Slava Kurilev. I'm done. Thank you.